So welcome back. I hope everybody had enough sleep. And now we will be continuing the talks with pivoting in Amazon Cloud's VMware-based cloud infrastructure by Andres Riaco.
Yep.
I hope I pronounced that right. Okay, so please.
Okay, so in yesterday's speakers dinner, one of the organizers told us that we were not saying enough cyber. So now my talk is going to be about cyber privacy analysis on the cloud using big data, APT, Hadoop servers. So with all those buzzwords, do I get your attention? It's an interesting talk, yeah? So this talk has some buzzwords. I'm going to be talking about cloud, which is kind of, oh, the cloud. But it's going to be mostly technical. It doesn't have any kind of, I would say, opinions on my side. It's purely technical. So let's start. I'm going to be telling you about a story. This is a story on, sorry, could you lower the thing? I think it's too loud. Thank you. This is a story of how I was running a pen test, a web application pen test, and the application that I was testing was hosted in the Amazon cloud. So these were the steps that I followed in order to own the architecture, own the whole setup in the Amazon cloud. After I finished my pen test, I thought it was going to be interesting for you to hear what I did, the different misconfigurations and the different steps that I took in order to achieve what I did. So let's start. The first vulnerability that I found was a very simple, non-cloud related vulnerability. It was an HTTP request proxy vulnerability. This basically means that the target application has some script that takes a parameter, and that parameter is a URL. When I perform this request, it's going to follow these steps. So from my laptop, it's going to go to the vulnerable web application. The vulnerable web application will take this URL, and it's going to perform an HTTP request to the URL that I control, get the response, and then send back the response to me. Okay? This is a basic web vulnerability. You can find this in, I would say, one out of 50 web applications. Right? It's kind of common, and it's usually low risk. Okay? It's when you are doing a pen test, you're going to tag this as low or maybe medium risk, okay? So when I was running this pen test, I found this vulnerability, and I tested this. Instead of putting here google.com or some other random domain, I performed a request to this fixed IP address and this fixed path. And the response that I got was AMI and some number. And I was really, really happy about this. Anyone knows why? Any clues on why I was so happy? Yes?
Internal IP address?
Yes, this is an internal IP address. But why I am requesting this specific internal IP address? Any ideas? No? Great. So if you don't have any ideas about why I'm doing this, you're going to learn a lot during this talk. Okay? So I was very happy. But why was I so happy? It was because I was accessing the instance metadata. Let me explain. Each time that you're in the Amazon cloud and you start an EC2 server, Amazon is going to attach an instance metadata to that server. The instance metadata is just an HTTP server which is only accessible from that instance. So each server in Amazon, in the EC2 service, has its own metadata server. Okay? And there is information in that metadata server which can be accessed just by performing an HTTP request to this IP address and by knowing the path that where that information is. Okay? What we did before was access this path, which provides us with the AMI ID. AMI is Amazon Machine Image, and it's basically the operating system image that's going to be running in that EC2 instance. If you know the path, you can also access the private IP address, the instance type. The instance type is if you start an instance and you want to assign it with, let's say, 8 cores and some random amount of RAM, you're going to have a medium type instance. If you want less CPU power, you're going to have a small instance. So by accessing the different paths here, you get the instance type and you know how big of a server you are penetrating. And you also get the Amazon region and some other information that we are going to be exploring today. So at this moment, during my pen test, this is how it was looking. It was my laptop, the vulnerable web application, and now some kind of metadata server which lives there and can be only accessed from this vulnerable server. All right? So something that I wanted to do was to access all the information that was available in this metadata server. To access all the information, there are libraries to do that. Like developers use the metadata for doing things. Like they access the metadata to know the private IP address, and based on that, they do something. I don't know. So developers use this, and because they use it, it's in the libraries, in the cloud, Amazon cloud libraries that people use, like for example, Boto and Fog. There is a procedure, there are functions for accessing information in this metadata. So I wanted to use that in order to access all the information from the remote instance metadata. Remember that Boto is going to think that it's running in an EC2 instance, and it will try to directly access the 169 IP address, okay? And we want to modify it in order to, instead of accessing the local 169 IP address, to go through this vulnerability that we found and to reach the remote metadata server, okay? We want to do some kind of trick in order to make Boto think that it's going to be accessing the local IP address, but it's actually going through the vulnerability, okay? In order to do that, I did something called monkey patching in Python, which is a way of replacing functions that you don't control. And the function that I don't control and that I want to modify is the one that performs HTTP requests. I did this monkey patching for Boto, and it looks like this. Basically, in this module, in a project that I'm going to tell you about, I define this function, the mangle function, and it's going to have some kind of vulnerable URL and with the target. And here, we're going to put the different 169 URLs that Boto is going to access. By doing this, I perform a request through this vulnerability, parse the response, and I'm fooling Boto into believing that it's accessing something local when it's actually accessing the remote instance metadata. With that, it was possible to create a tool called NimboStratus. NimboStratus is an open source tool. You will get the link and everything later. This open source tool is going to allow you to do different things in a vulnerable Amazon deployment. And in this case, what you can do is to dump the EC2 metadata. So in this case, we say dump EC2 metadata. We pass the mangle function, which is the one that we defined previously. And here you can see how Boto is fooled in order to perform the requests through the vulnerable application. Okay? We access different paths in that server, and we get the information. Okay? We know that it's a T1 micro. It's the smallest EC2 instance that exists. We know that it's some kind of AMI ID. If you search online for that ID, you will be able to know the operating system. You will be able to know the operating system version and some other information. And there's also a security group attached to that instance. Security groups are like firewall rules, okay? We know the availability zone, the architecture, the private IP address. So there's a lot of information from here to here, which is important for an attacker, all right? Using that information, he could perform more complex attacks. He could perform different actions. But something that's interesting, and I haven't told you about, is something called user data. And we are, with this dump EC2 metadata, we are dumping the user data, okay? But what is user data? You know, when you're on the cloud, when you're on the Amazon cloud, one of the things that you want to achieve is that based on the load of the system, you want more servers to be active or less servers to be active. So at some point, when you have a peak in traffic, the load balancer is going to decide, you know what? I need more instances, more servers to handle this traffic. So it's going to turn on some server. And when that server is turned on, it requires some basic configuration, like, okay, I need the source code to this web application. I need some, I don't know, Apache configuration, Nginx configuration. It needs to configure itself in some way. There are different ways of doing that. So when the instance, when the operating system is starting, there are different ways to configure it. One of the ways is using user data. User data are operating system boot scripts. So when the instance is starting, the operating system, and at least in Ubuntu, it will use something called Cloud Init Daemon. Ubuntu will go to the instance metadata, retrieve the user data script, and run it in that operating system. So, and from the perspective of the developer or the Amazon architect, you can define that user data for those instances. So you can say, for the web servers, I want this user data script to be run. For the database server, I want this user data script, okay? And they are basically initialization steps for having a working server. All right, so we can get that user data. And I told you that in most cases, they are initialization steps. So during my pen test, what I found was this. The user data script had a repository URL Of course, I changed this. It had the deploy private key, the deploy public key, and it had some functions defined here in order to get the source code and configure itself in order to be ready to receive HTTP requests. So I was very happy, of course, because I had the repository and I had the way to access the repository. With this, I was able to get the source code for all the application. Okay, using those credentials, I was able to get the source code for the application. At that point, I had different options. One of the options was to read the source code and to try to find different vulnerabilities in that source code. But that's kind of boring. It takes a lot of time to go through a lot of source code, and it's static code, source code review is not that much fun. So what I thought is, okay, cloud applications consume cloud services. You know, when you're building an application, a web application, or a software as a service on the cloud, you're building it on the cloud because you want to use the cloud services. Let me give you an example. Let's say that you want to build an Instagram clone. Everybody knows what Instagram is, okay? So Instagram, you upload images and people say, oh yeah, they are beautiful. So in this case, what happens if you want to create an Instagram clone on the Amazon cloud, you're going to use at least two services from Amazon. You're going to use the S3 service in order to store the images that people upload. S3 is kind of a very large hard drive that will never, you will never fill that hard drive, okay? That's S3 in very simple words. And then you will use something like DynamoDB, which is a NoSQL database, in order to store some kind of index of this person owns this other image or this other set of images. And in this infrastructure that you're building, the front-end web application needs to have credentials to access S3. Needs to have some kind of username, password, API key, something to authenticate from here to the S3 API and upload images or delete those images or do different actions, take different actions. So we know that if people are building stuff on the cloud, they will at some point need credentials to access from here to here. One of the recommended ways by Amazon for doing this is something called instance profile. So if you want to assign credentials to an instance, you are going to use an instance profile. Instance profiles are just like users. You create an instance profile. It's kind of the same process of creating a user. You create a user, you attach some permissions to that user, permissions like you are going to be able to access the S3 service. You are going to be able to access the, RDS service, permissions for a user. And those instance profiles are then attached to each instance. So when an instance starts, it will have, in some way, it will have those credentials ready for using them. That way is to make the credentials available in the metadata server. And you know what? We have access to the metadata server because of that initial vulnerability. So if we use once again Nimbostratus and we use the same trick that I showed you before, but in this case we access a specific path that before was unknown to us. We dump the credentials, and we get these credentials. This means that using those access key, secret key, and the token, if we configure them in our workstation outside from the Amazon architecture, if we configure this in our workstation and we access any API from Amazon, we're going to be impersonating the user that's running attached to the front-end server of the target application that we are hacking. Okay, so we have, for now, we have this, which is kind of not very meaningful, right? It's just a long string. It doesn't tell us anything about anything. We don't know which permissions are attached to this. So I created a tool called dump permissions, which is going to perform, using those credentials that we got before, it's going to try to perform different actions against the different API endpoints from the Amazon cloud. And simply if I perform the action and it's telling me you don't have permissions, then I don't have permissions for taking that action. If I try to perform the action and it says here's the response, then okay, I have permissions for taking that action. So with these permissions, I know after running the dump permissions subcommand of NimbusStratus, I know that I have permissions for performing the action list queues on the resource star, okay? So I can do list queues on everything. For now, this is not very helpful, but at least we know what we can do. After looking around a little bit, I found that list queues was an API call for the SQS service. SQS is basically a queue. It's a queue where you're going to put tasks on one side, and then you're going to consume them from the other side, okay? It's a distributed queue, it's very nice, but it's basically a queue. Using Boto and Python, if you don't code in Python, please stand up and go away. Using Boto and Python, I connected to and the credentials that I got. I connect to the SQS servers and I get all the queues. When I do a get all queues, it means that it's going to be calling the list queues API. And I get some information. I get the name of one of the queues. Then I get the queue. I have a queue object now. I start getting messages. I get one message from the queue. And from that message, I get the body. So I'm trying to inspect what the application is sending to that queue. Okay. And by inspecting that, I find two important things, two important pieces of information. The first one is content type application X Python serialize. And the second piece of information, which is important, is routing key celery. Something else that I want to know is if I have permissions to write a message to the SQS queue. And performing those steps, I know that I'm able to do it, okay? I know that with those credentials that I stole from the remote server, I can access the, I have write access to the SQS queue. Perfect, all right, next step. We saw at some point that in the messages that were sent to the SQS queue, it said celery. Google for celery, and you find this. Distributed task queue. Basically, what celery does is when you're on this server and you want to send a task to the queue, you will use the Celery library. You will use that library to serialize the different parameters for the task that you want to run. Serialize means transforming objects into a string. You want to serialize them in order to go through the queue. And then on the other side, you're going to have workers consuming tasks from the queue. And those workers are also going to use Celery in order to get the object from the queue, get the string from the queue, and transform it into an object. OK? So this is how the architecture looks like now for us. Looking around, I found that in the Celery documentation, there is a section on security. And I said, all right, that looks good. I'm going to read through it and try to find the weaknesses in Celery. So there's a section that says exactly this. It says, the default pickle serializer is convenient because it supports arbitrary Python objects, whereas other serializers only work with a restricted set of types. If you're a developer, you stop reading here, because it's telling you the default is better than the other ones. The default has more features than the other ones. So you're a developer. You want to do things. You want to deliver software. You want to deliver features. So developers, stop reading here. But now, if you're interested into security, you continue reading. But for the same reasons, the Pickle serializer is inherently insecure. OK. And should be avoided. Ah, interesting. Whenever clients are untrusted or unauthenticated. OK. Kind of makes sense. So untrusted or unauthenticated, what does this mean? It means that if someone else can write messages here, in this scenario, clients are this and this. So if clients are unauthenticated or untrusted, then, and you're using the Pickle serializer, then you have a very big security issue. OK. So clients in this scenario are these guys and these guys. But we have, and in this scenario, if you look at it this way, the clients are trusted, and they are authenticated, because trusted means that I, developer, control the source code here and control the source code here. And access to the queue is authenticated, because from this front-end web server, you need credentials to access the SQS queue. So it's authenticated and it's trusted. The problem is that we were able to get access to the credentials that this guy uses to access the SQS queue. So now it's kind of authenticated, but we broke the authentication part. Okay, and we proved that we were able to write messages to the SQS queue. So we are in this scenario, okay? Clients are unauthenticated, so we are going to have an issue. But what's the issue? What's the problem with the Pickle serializer? And let me remind you, if we go back, we're going to see here that it's using content type application XPython serialize. If you go through the Celery source code, you're going to see that that means Pickle, okay? So it's using the default Pickle serializer in this environment. But what's wrong with Pickle? Why is it inherently insecure? If you go to the link that's there, you're going to kind of find something like this. You're going to find something like, and this is once again a Python interpreter running different commands. Import pico.dump to a string, an object. So it's going to transform that object into a string. For now, it's a feature. It works like that. It's OK. Then you load a string. You load this, and it's going to return the object once again. So that's basic 101 serialization of objects. Nothing strange until there. But now there is something that it's a kind of a known feature slash vulnerability in Pico, that if you load an arbitrary string, you are going to end up executing operating system commands. Okay? So this is the vulnerability with the Pico serializer. And because Celery uses Pico, we can use this in our favor to get access to the system. Let's see. So we want to get a reverse shell from Pico's. That means that we want to send a payload using the Amazon SQS API. We want to write something very specific to the SQS queue there. And we are going to write that information to the queue. And when one of the workers takes that message from the queue and wants to unpickle the string, and because we wrote something very specific, that worker is going to execute our arbitrary command. And that arbitrary command is going to do the reverse shell and do a connection back to our server and give us access for running arbitrary commands on these workers. Okay? So I automated this Celery Pico exploit. You need to send the access key, the secret key, and then you send the address where you want the connection to be created to. The name of the queue where we are going to write the messages. The name of the queue, the region where that SQS queue lives. The region is basically the Amazon data center where this queue was created. And with that, you execute this, and after some seconds, you get a connection back in your server, and you can run arbitrary commands. So far, so good. We got access. We got access to executing arbitrary commands on one of the workers. That's very nice. We gain access through the back door. That's kind of important to understand because we sent something directly to the SQS queue. At the SQS queue, when you send this, you're going to be creating a TCP connection to something like sqs.amazon.com. And using your credentials, you send the information there. This means that there is no firewall that can protect you. There is no firewall that can say, you know what, the SQS queue only allow the IP addresses from the front-end web servers to access. There is no way of doing that. So we kind of gain access through using the cloud thinking, the cloud architecture, we gain access to this. OK, so we have access to that backend server, to one of the Celery workers. And we know that that server has access to the SQS queue. And we know that it has access because it took the message, the specially crafted message, it took it from the queue, unpickled it, and commands were executed in that process. And we know that it has access, and because of that, it will have in some place credentials are going to be stored in order to access the SQS queue. After taking a look around and trying to find the credentials, I found that they were configured in a different way. They were not made available through an instance profile. They were made available through a configuration file. So the worker has some broker.py file in which it has the credentials to access the SQS queue. But once again, it's for now, it's simply a string. We don't know what this means. So we get these strings, and we dump the permissions for those access key and secret key. And we get something interesting. We get that this access key and secret key have access to SQS, which makes sense because it needs to access the SQS API. It needs to access any resource. Maybe you could, as an Amazon developer, you could have limited this a little bit more and said something like, I want to be able to only read messages instead of any action on SQS. You want only the workers to be able to read and write messages to the queue instead of all the actions. And I want, instead of any queue, if you're trying to configure this in a secure way, you could have said only grant access to the queue with name ABC. But well, we have access to SQS. This is nothing very new or surprising. And also, from the workers, we have access to something called IAM. OK, perfect. And we have access to performing any action on any resource in the IAM API from the Amazon Cloud. OK, we write this into a post-it. We save it there. We're going to try to understand what IAM is later. Keeping analyzing my newly owned server, I found that I was, or the application, the Celery worker, was connecting to a MySQL database. And that the credentials were just there, okay? Databases.py, the database configuration, username, password, and the host where that server, that MySQL server is running. I connect to that database, try to find interesting information, try to find sensitive private information. Nothing is found. I just find logs and some other uninteresting things. So I was just about to, I was just about to forget about this when I noticed that it said, like the host was kind of strange, right? It said Nimbostratus something AP Southeast something rds.amazonawebservice.com. And RDS, but if you're kind of used to the Amazon Cloud naming convention, and you're kind of learning this, you're going to see that everything has three letters, like SQS, EC2, RDS, IAM. They're like three letters everywhere, and you need to learn them. So I Googled for RDS, and I found that RDS is a managed SQL Server service. So when you want a database, you are going to go to the RDS API and say, you know what? I want a database, a MySQL database, that has 10 gigs of storage, and I want it now. And Amazon is going to spend 2 or 5 minutes And after that, it will tell you the host where you can access the MySQL server. It's very, very easy to use, and it will provide you with a SQL server ready to use. You don't need to configure anything. It's kind of, that's the service, that you don't need to configure anything. You can do backups very quickly and stuff like that. So that's RDS. So the MySQL server is running in the RDS service from Amazon. And this is how it looks for us right now. We have the front-end application, the SQS server, the workers, and we know that from each worker, we can access MySQL and IAM. Perfect. But something that we're going to do is to perform an IAM privilege escalation. But what is IAM? IAM is identity and access management. This basically means that if you want to configure a user, you want to configure an instance profile, you want to configure a group, permissions, or anything related to those concepts, you're going to use the IAM service. The IAM service has a web application that you can use to configure all the groups and everything, or you can use the API to do the same actions. You can send an action to that service saying, create a new user. And luckily for us, we have IAM star access. That means that our secret key and access key, our credentials, have access to performing any action on any resource on the IAM API. Which is great, because any action could be create a new user. Any action could be assign all the permissions to that user. And then another action could be give me the credentials, the access key and the secret key for that user. So we do that in an automated way. And we say create IAM user, access key something, secret key something. These two are the ones that we got from the Celery worker. And this is going to communicate with the IAM API, and it's going to create a random user with a random name with all the privileges, and it will give us the access key and the secret key. Once again, and in order to verify, we dump the permissions for those newly created credentials, and we see that we can take any action on any resource, which is perfect. So now we have kind of root access at the Amazon Web Service level. This means that if we want, we don't want to do it, but if we want, we could shut down all of the EC2 instances from that particular client. We can remove any databases, we can do anything we want, okay? But something that we do want is to get access to this MySQL database, because we know that there is something more. We feel when I was running that pen test and I was connecting to the MySQL database using the low privileged user, I kind of felt on the bytes that were on the network, I was feeling it, that there was something more on the other side. It was like a real feeling, you know? So I wanted to access that MySQL server with high privileges. I wanted to do it. So trying to understand what we have until now, perfect. Trying to understand what we have until now, we have from a MySQL client with the no root credentials, we can connect to MySQL, to this MySQL that was accessible from the Celery workers. We also know that this MySQL instance is running in the RDS service. And we know that we have access to perform any action on the RDS service. Okay. So looking and trying to understand which were my options at that point, I went through the RDS documentation, and I found a couple of system calls or API calls that were interesting. One was create a database snapshot. I was able to create a backup of that MySQL instance. Okay, so, and I was also able to restore that snapshot in a new RDS instance. So restoring this snapshot was create a new server with that same information. And there was another call that I was able to do, which was change the root password of any RDS database instance, which is great. And I wasn't really going to change the root password for the running instance because I didn't want to break anything. Maybe there is some application using the root user to connect to that MySQL, and I didn't want to break anything. So I simply, from the instance that I wanted to get access, I created a backup, restored the backup, and now we have two MySQL instances with the same information. For the newly created one, I changed the password and accessed that information, okay? So this is possible to do, it's very easy. Snapshot RDS, you send some parameters, you send the password that you want on the restored database instance. And after waiting some minutes for the snapshot to complete, to the restore process to complete, and stuff like that, the command is going to tell you, use this MySQL client to access, and you can get access to all the information which was available in that MySQL instance. And this is just me showing the databases. There was an important database. And then because I was root, before I was only able to see the logs database. Now I was able to see the important database also. I use it, and I was able to get some important information. Okay, so I was kind of racking the cloud. I was very happy at this point. I was able to get Amazon Web Service root access because I had permissions for taking any action on any resource without any limitation. I was able to get arbitrary command execution on the salary workers. I was able to get the source code for the salary worker and the source code for the front-end web application. And I think that was about it. Like, it was a good pen test, yeah. Some conclusions for today. Developers are working on the cloud. There are a lot of new kind of systems being developed. A lot of them are using the Amazon cloud or Rackspace or whatever other cloud provider they are using. It's very convenient to use the cloud for developing applications. I'm doing it, and it's really convenient. Before I started with this pen test, before I started to learn about the Amazon cloud, I thought that cloud was a buzzword. It was kind of stupid and nobody should use it. But after really going into it, it's like magic. Like, it's very good. So you guys should try to learn about these things. It's not that hard. It's not going to take you any money. Amazon Web Services has a free tier. That means that you subscribe, and they are going to give you access to a server and some other things for free. You don't have to pay anything. That lasts for a year. Then you need to start paying. It's like your dealer, when you go for the first time, the drug is for free, and then you need to pay. And most vulnerabilities and misconfigurations that I showed today are just that. They are misconfigurations. There are problems that are generated because the developers and the architects working on the cloud, they are not taking the secure decision. They are kind of taking a decision, which is not always the secure and the safe decision. It's my opinion that it's not an Amazon issue to fix. So developers and people working on the cloud should be the ones knowing about these risks and trying to develop and create the Amazon infrastructure they want in a secure way. Just 30 more seconds. The source code for everything that I showed you is here. And also something that I created was a vulnerable architecture. That means you know, I'm going to go back to this slide, okay? Let me show you this. I created two different tools. One, the one that I showed you, the one that you can use to exploit weak Amazon deployments. And I created a different tool, which is kind of a hack me cloud, which you run one command, and it's going to create all of this. It's going to create it for you on the Amazon cloud. So you can start playing, okay? You download the source code for the Nimbostratus target, and you run, you get your credentials from Amazon. You run one command, and you have an SQS queue, the front-end web server, the workers, and the RDS database, configured in a way that you can start playing and reproduce exactly what I said today, okay? So this Nimbostratus target will allow you to reproduce each step of what I told you today. You can go home today and start playing. And the Nimbostratus target is going to help you perform these actions. Me, this email address, this Twitter account. I hope you guys enjoyed my talk. Any questions? The engagement was like 3 weeks. I was able to complete all of these steps in the first one. But there's a trick behind this. I already knew about Amazon before starting with this. I was already playing with the Amazon cloud before starting my engagement. So, and I was playing with it for like 3 months. So I was very knowledgeable about some weaknesses and some problems in the Amazon cloud. Without that knowledge, without that previous training, if I would go into an engagement where I don't know about Amazon and I find the first vulnerability, the HTTP proxy vulnerability, it would be almost impossible to achieve all of this. Any other questions?
I'm afraid we have been
guys,
running out of time.
Yep,
so.
Sorry. Meet you outside if you have any questions or you want to tell me that I suck. Let's go outside and I kill you. Thank you.